I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source. We're on the college tour, and we're struck by the symptoms of distress in the bluest of blue ribbon industries, the growth engine, the way to the future, the way to wisdom, we used to say. But the talk is different around commencement 2014. In families and at faculty tables, the talk is about debt, division, disinvestment. $35,000, the price of a very good car, is the average debt of the new alumni. Meantime, class lines are hardening between colleges, public, private, and for-profit, between tenured faculty and insecure temps who do the teaching. And the cost of the 08 meltdown kicks in with a vengeance as states, one by one, pull back from their prize institutions and tuitions rocket upward. So for families and kids, the financial burden of higher ed is doubled or more. And for many, the gateway is barred to those public schools that did three quarters of all the teaching. The editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education, Liz McMillan, is going to lead us through it. The president of Lesley University in Cambridge, Joseph Moore, and the writer professor at University of Virginia, Siva Vaidyanathan, are going to touch all the bases. But first, part of our homework was dropping in on the National College Fair at the Convention Center in Boston last week, a giant trade show around diplomas for parents, kids, and admissions officers.
We have 75 different areas of studies divided between a College of Arts and Sciences, a business school, and an art school.
Marietta itself is a lively community. Marietta was just listed as one of the top six small towns in America to visit.
The tuition is just over $32,000. And then room and board would bring it up to about $46,000.
I looked at Colorado because I like to ski.
Worcester State University, Keene State College, University of Albany, SUNY, University of Alabama, Simmons College.
So a little bit about our school. We're located in Western Massachusetts. We're about 15 minutes from Six Flags, New England.
Students need a college degree. There is no doubt. You're not going to go any place unless you have that college degree.
The value is they can go on and get a good job. It's an investment in your future.
I want to go to college because I want to make a lot of money. It kind of sounds pretty rude, but that's kind of where it's at.
Yeah, and it is expensive. Unfortunately, it just keeps going up and up.
There aren't jobs for every student that graduates every single year. But if you don't have that education, how are you going to compete with the people who do?
Finance, accounting, management, marketing, operations information management is commanding some of our highest salaries at the moment.
All this for a great value, about $43,000 a year is the sticker price.
What's happening to higher education this hour? 800-423-8255 is the phone to join the conversation. 800-423-TALK. Speak from your own experience. Liz McMillan in Washington edits the Chronicle of Higher Education, where all the arguments in the industry get laid out. Would you sort for us, please, Liz McMillan, the real problems, the pseudo problems, and maybe the deeper problems that haven't surfaced yet? Welcome.
Sure. I'm happy to. I think the important thing to remember here is that colleges reflect what's happening in the rest of the world. They're essentially a mirror for society. People talk about the ivory tower, and that's not really the case here. So what's happening in the wider world right now is the increasing divide between haves and have-nots and the growing concentration of wealth among the upper classes and essentially the disappearance of the middle class. And I think the question is whether colleges are able to help people bridge that divide as they once did, or whether they are making things worse by reinforcing a kind of caste system. So I had a couple of specific data points that I wanted to just share with the audience.
Please.
And drawing from some very important research from Anthony Carnevale at Georgetown, who did a really interesting study on this last year. And he found that there are essentially two educational paths for people in this country, one for whites and another for Hispanics and African Americans. And to go a little bit deeper onto that, he found that since 1995, 82% of white enrollments have gone to the 468 most selective colleges in the country, while 72% of Hispanic enrollment and 68% of African American enrollment have gone to two-year and open access schools, the least selective colleges with the smallest amount of resources. And, of course, all of the selective colleges are the richest colleges in the country. Mm. They have lots of money, and then they tend to have higher graduation rates.
So the college admission is reinforcing the divide. I mean, the essay question for the hour really is higher education a bridge to the middle class or a barrier? Sounds like
That's
a barrier.
Correct. It's some people feel very strongly that it is. And how it continues is that once higher education, these two pathways, the selective and the least selective, start sending people into the labor market, well, naturally, people coming from selective colleges are going into the professional world where their ability to earn higher salaries over the entire course of their lifetime is quite high. And while the less selective institutions, some of the two-year schools, some of the for-profit schools, are tracking people into more vocational work. So when people talk about how higher education is an engine of inequality, this is what they're getting at.
You haven't mentioned the big word debt yet. What are the funding issues, the real ones, the important ones, Liz?
Right. So I think what's happening there kind of globally is the shifting of the burden of who pays for college onto students and their families. So I think the average debt right now for students coming out is just under $30,000. Some of it's lower, some of it's higher. And there are real constraints that debt places on things like job choices and things like buying a house, potentially depressing local economies. And understandably, there's been a real activist organization coalescing around this issue. And there's some other factors about what's happening with the public higher education system that's driving that as well. And then finally, in terms of the big issues to sketch out, is how all of these things combining, so concern about debt, concern about rising tuition, and the really tough jobs outlook for any graduate who's come out since the recession, since 2008, they're all coming together and they're raising questions about the value of going to college. And you see this kind of commentary and opinion in all of the major newspapers. But frankly, your earning potential is much worse if you don't get some kind of college education.
At the same time, every college is disclosing now the expected income of the graduates. This is a sobering number. It barely covers the cost of getting through.
True. But that also, we would say, possibly raises questions about, is a college degree just about a paycheck? Is it about something larger than that? I think it's unfortunate that right now in this economy, a lot of attention is being paid to jobs, and it's understandable.
Well, the kids we hear from were talking a value proposition, and they're being sold a value proposition.
Right.
Which is not the way you and I were sent off to college.
Absolutely not. And there's been an absolute change in the last generation of what's happened to the college experience.
You've written about that, and I want to get to it, Liz, but I also want to get to the non-serious issues. I mean, 2 years ago, we thought MOOCs were going to wipe out the nation.
The whole educational establishment.
Online education.
Yeah.
It now seems interesting and maybe useful, but not at the core of the problem. What do you think?
I agree. I think that there has been a lot of hype and a lot of excitement, even a bubble around MOOCs in the last 18 months, and talk about how they were going to replace the whole residential college system. I think there is quite a bit of much more sober conversation about that potential. Problems that some of these courses have with completion rates, thousands and thousands of students around the world taking them, not completing them, is an issue. And so I think people are perhaps recalibrating about what the potential for MOOCs are and what the potential for hybrid kinds of courses are in a traditional university setting.
Let's speak to maybe neurotic but parental anxiety out there about my kids.
Yes. I think, you know, we've reached a kind of fever pitch of anxiety about whether kids are going to get into the Ivy League or Stanford or Chicago or any of the most elite institutions in this country. And some of it, frankly, is stoked by mainstream media. There's just a whole concentration about the process of getting into college, frankly, going all the way back to, you know, kindergarten, first grade. And it seems awfully overheated to me. And maybe we need a reality check. There are lots of places that offer very good educations. They're not necessarily the Ivy Leagues. So,
Liz, we're going to speak to the sort of the unknown unknown issues, the what would kind of be known as black swans. The, you know, British Petroleum Gulf problem. Suddenly, an over-engineered process is collapsing. What are the dangers out there in education?
Right. So one of the things that I'm concerned that lots of people don't understand is how the workforce on campuses is really profoundly changing. So when I went to school, when others went to school, you were typically taught by full-time tenure-track professors. They were often there for the course of their career. And as a result of all the financial pressures on colleges, many universities are cutting costs and they're hiring what is known as adjunct instructors. These serve semester by semester, sometimes year by year. They earn an average of $3,000 a course. They make a living in a place like Boston teaching at several institutions at once. And the balance has shifted so much now that the tenured faculty makes up about a third of college faculty in this country right now. So, you know, adjunct professors are really struggling. They don't have offices. They don't have health benefits.
Do they have a union?
And I know they are increasingly having unions. Yes, that is.
And can they fight about it? Does the tenured faculty care?
I think some tenured faculty do care. I think that's been key to some of the union developments. Yes.
We're talking about higher education in transition, maybe in a trap. In Boston this week, we talked with some earnest strivers at Northeastern University and Bunker Hill Community College.
It's absolutely worth it.
It's $50,000 a year.
It's absolutely worth it. Like, people meet the people they spend the rest of their lives with in college. How do you put a value on that? How do you value that?
The college debt isn't the best thing, though, but I would definitely recommend it. You need a degree nowadays. Thankfully, I get a decent amount of financial aid in the meantime. But I work two jobs. I get student loans. It's challenging.
Doesn't look too good for the future, for me or for the rest of the college-going population, honestly.
So how do you pay for it?
A lot of debt, like most people who go here. Just water under the bridge. It's totally fine. Not fine. I wish it was less expensive, but I think it's worth it. I'm not bitter.
I just worked and saved, and community is very cheap with in-state, and made sure I got in-state tuition, and very cheap.
How much is it, in-state tuition?
Maybe $1,600 to $1,800 a semester for four classes, which is cheaper than anything.
The sticker price at Northeastern is $54,000 a year. At Bunker Hill, it is under $2,000 per semester. Joseph Moore in our studio is the president of Lesley University in Cambridge, ever up and coming in the shadow of the great Harvard science buildings. I think I remember, Joe, when it was Lesley Junior College, and now it's a university. What is your sticker price, by the way?
This coming fall, it'll be $24,000 for undergraduates for tuition and about $14,000 for room and board. We've lowered the tuition from this year to next year.
I want you to give us the view and your own map of higher education from the perspective of the, shall we say, the Lesley sector, private, nonprofit, smallish, scrambling to stay in business and do well.
We're a mid-sized private nonprofit, so we enroll in any given year about 7,500 students. We're a bit larger than a lot of people in Boston realize, but we're still a small private nonprofit. We have a diverse portfolio of programs. We have over 5,500 graduate students. We have a couple thousand undergraduate students all enrolled in four different schools. So this diverse portfolio addresses adult learners that are going back to complete a bachelor's degree, traditional age students, adults that are going back for master's or people completing a doctoral study. And I think in this day and age, having a diverse range of audiences that we serve gives some strength to the university.
Are you vulnerable? And are you in a competitive fight, even for survival? With whom?
Well, I think each of the sectors in higher ed, including ours, faces financial challenges.
Remind us who they are.
Well, from my point of view, there's six sectors in higher ed. There's the very selective privates. There's the national flagship research public universities. There are the private, moderately selective institutions, about 1,000 of them, like Lesley. There are the public community colleges that enroll over 10 million students across the country, which are usually left out of the media conversations. And then there's the for-profit sector, which most people, frankly, don't understand very well. So the financial variables in each of these sectors are quite different, and they do reflect what Liz was talking about earlier in terms of this increasing divide. And they play themselves out through these six sectors.
Who's in trouble and why? I'm thinking, I got to tell you, of Clay Christensen, who is a sort of a disruption guru at the Harvard Business School. He says something to the effect, I'm pretty close, in 15 years, half of these colleges and universities will be gone.
Those generalizations, I need to have more detail. I would say that in each of the sectors that I identified, there are groupings within each of the sectors that are facing serious financial challenges, whether it's community colleges that are not allowed to raise their tuition because of legislative oversight, and their appropriations have been cut and they have increasing demand. That's a major threat. The for-profits, many of them are threatened because the majority of their funds come from federal funds. The students are the vehicle through which those funds are returned as profit to investors. The sector that we're in, the moderately selective privates, our institutions grew with the middle class that grew over the last 100 years in this country. That middle class is eviscerating before our eyes, so that's a threat to ours.
I was going to say, connect all this with what Liz was saying about the general economy, the pattern of our society.
From 1980 to 2000, family income did not keep pace with the tuition hikes, but family income was raising. After 2000, family incomes have declined while tuitions continue to rise at a slower rate, but the publics went up faster even because of the drop in state appropriation.
But it's the families who are being asked to take up the burden here.
That's absolutely right. Financial aid has been relatively flat. The loan program, I think, is very poorly managed. And the institutions, we have to figure out a way to control our cost and also gain some productivity with the use of technology.
Why, Joe, small point, but it's interesting. Why was it a strategic move for you to raise your price in this atmosphere?
Well, there are two camps when you look at private college tuition. There's the Chevis Regal group that believes that you get what you pay for. And so the notion was, let's keep raising it and we'll redirect some of those funds, the tuition funds, into student aid. And then there's increasingly the group of which I'm a part, which is the sticker shock group. And that is, with the decline in family income, too many students can't even afford to stick around once they see the price and find out what institutional aid is available. At Lesley, we contribute 8 times what the federal government does to aid to our students in the form of grants. I'm not talking about loans. We do $16 million in institutional grants to $2 million in Pell Grants. And we have a healthy percentage of about 28% of our students who receive Pell Grants. So I think we've got to get the price lower. And the shift to us from a projected next year of $32,000 to $24,000, I wish we could do even more. But we've got to make the price more affordable. We've got to reduce the loan burden. We've got to figure out what we can do on that.
The sticker price is shocking, but there are discounts, in other words,
yes,
on that high-priced Chevis Regal whiskey. I want to introduce Siva Vaidyanathan, who watches higher ed from inside. Last time we spoke, Siva, you were teaching media at NYU. You're back now in the public zone that you like better at the University of Virginia. We read you always with provocation and interest in the Chronicle and the New York Times and online. What's your take on the real issues, the bogus issues, the unseen issues?
Well, Liz McMillan and Joseph Moore have done an outstanding job giving the big picture. And the big picture, I think, we can take from Joe's description of the various different systems of higher education. There is no one higher education system in the United States. There are all sorts of different institutions that perform different functions in different contexts. Grouping them all together doesn't really help us analyze situations or make good decisions. No two schools are easily comparable. MIT and Harvard is difficult. You know, let's be frank about it. Those are two very different institutions that do very different things in the world. Comparing UMass Boston and Lesley University, that's a little bit better in terms of the student population they're trying to serve, but they're still very different institutions and very hard to compare. So when you're looking at this situation, the thing to remember, though, and if you want to take the big picture, I think it's good to, is that what we have seen over the last 30 years or so is a steady disinvestment from public higher education, accompanied by, in the last 10 years, an alarming disinvestment in funding for science research and funding for instance, Medicaid reimbursements. And when you combine those things, those retreats from the public commitment that universities play in our society and all their different roles, you're going to put tremendous cost pressures on universities.
Shiva, I got to tell you, this is sort of news to me. Where was I, and what was the public participation in the decision to cut, for example, state aid to the University of Massachusetts?
Well, you know, that was the thing. And actually, Massachusetts hasn't been the worst perpetrator of this.
But overall, it's something like a 25% cut in the public assistance.
And there are states that have done worse. And what really happened was the recession around 2001 was the point at which most states started panicking about the amount of money that they were pouring into higher education, the commitment they had made to serve the state at large, and they almost all in chorus made a decision to shift the burden to students. Now think about this. A state university in any decent-sized state in the United States perform so many different functions. They run hospitals. They run teaching hospitals that train doctors and nurses. They do agricultural research. They have extension services that help people to do better irrigation in fields. They perform public health roles. They perform cultural roles. They have sports and theater and comedy. They provide public services in 100 other different ways, and they enrich communities. And all of these functions have been enriching American life at every level across the United States for more than 150 years. And in a sudden turn, around 2001, states decided to pull out funding and essentially put the entire burden on the students, which is making a philosophical decision that only the students who go and get degrees from these universities, or in fact don't even get degrees from these universities, should pay for them. That's a really bad policy decision, considering how widely the benefits spread through society.
And this is all pre-meltdown, pre-2008.
Meltdown, but then it got really acute around 2007, 2008. So the trend had already started. The principle had started in the recession in 2001, but it really picked up heavily with the recession of 2008. Which was, of course, the Great Recession, a recession that was accompanied by a tremendous dip in stock value, which meant that endowments were shrinking across the board. Harvard, as rich as it is, lost a tremendous amount of money. No thanks to its mismanaging former president.
They're down to $32 billion in that endowment.
Nobody's crying for that. But, right? Nobody's crying for that, although I would say that does change the priorities of a lot of universities, and most universities don't carry that kind of bank account, and they had to make a lot of ugly decisions, and that involves raising tuition. Now, look at public universities, though.
I was going to say.
In the 1970s, the University of California system was close to free for in-state tuition. When I went to the University of Texas in the 1980s, tuition for in-state students was in the hundreds per semester. It might hit 1,000 for an entire year. That means that the people of the state of Texas and the people of the state of California were subsidizing the education of both rich and poor Texans and Californians. You could argue, and many did at the time, that tuition was too low at that point because you don't want to subsidize wealthy people quite so much. But the beauty of that was that it meant that people were able to graduate with little or no debt, regardless of whether they came from wealthy families or poor families or middle-class families. There was a commitment to a sense that if you could do the work, you should be able to get a degree from one of these excellent universities.
See, I want to bring Liz and Joe back into the conversation, but I want you to voice your own eternal enthusiasm about the promise of the publics, the public colleges.
Sure. Well, look,
public colleges.
Over the long term, you can't beat the value that these institutions have given to America. If you consider the web browser that you used a dozen times today, that came out of the University of Illinois, right? If you look at all of these different medical devices and innovations that have extended life and improved value of life, a good portion of them came out of research labs at public universities, including university hospitals. If you look at the fact that we understand the perils of climate change as well as we do, that's because of public universities. If you understand the fact that thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people have been given the chance as the first people in their families to go to college through public university systems in this country over the past 150 years, that's a tremendous amount of success. It's not something we should take for granted. It's something the rest of the world envies.
It's extraordinary.
And we take it for granted every day.
I think it was Howard Gardner's line that this system today and maybe ever works best for those new Americans, new people to higher education, and maybe at the public universities specifically. Joe, you got educated at the University of Massachusetts, but join some of these issues. And Liz, you too.
Well, please. I think, you know, the cost shift to the family in the public sector, it wasn't as if in the various state legislatures, I've been in three public systems, they didn't put their targets on public higher education. The economy shifted. There was less revenue coming into the states. They had to make decisions, and they saw students borrowing or getting grants or working or paying as an alternative, whereas in many of their other state accounts, they didn't see alternatives. And as opposed to the feds, they have to balance the budget each year. And so it's been a debilitating issue because of the decimation of the middle class that's been going on for the last 25 years. And so those of us who went similarly to UMass, where I think it was $250 a semester when I was there in the early 70s. These are nostalgic memories that have no place in the public policy discussion. Those days are behind us.
I disagree. They don't have to be behind us because they could very well be our goal if we decided to restore that level of commitment. And we can only restore that level of commitment if, as you say, we restore our commitment to making sure that middle-class Americans have the opportunity at a decent life, something that we have certainly turned all policies against.
Well,
our tax systems, our investments in public works, and our investment in education have all been geared away from making sure that the middle class has a decent shot in this country. And it's all part of the same pie. There's no reason we can't subsidize higher education, at least to the level of 1990 or 1999. That's not out of the question.
No, Siva, I
never want to go back to zero to $1,000 tuition, but we certainly could go inflation adjusted to $5,000 or $10,000, and all it would take is a renewal of that same commitment that did not drive states into the poorhouse. It just meant they had to make different decisions. They might have had to tax rich people a little bit higher. They might have had to reduce their highway spending a little bit more. They just had to make different decisions. But let's also remember that the federal government has rolled back, as you pointed out, a tremendous amount of support. Financial aid has been flat. That hasn't helped at all. The burden has been shifted to loans away from grants. That hasn't helped at all. The one way in which the federal government is actively subsidizing higher education is the worst way possible, which is through tax deductions for rich people to give gifts to their favorite universities. That just recycles the money through the winners. University of Massachusetts at Boston does not have a big, rich alumni base with a lot of people on Wall Street writing huge checks. And so it's unable to build up an endowment that can compete even with UMass Amherst. You know, that's a big problem because that's where our policy has shifted now, to benefit those who want tax deductions.
Siva, Liz, and Joe, I'm just struck that everything now in our conversation is Piketty revisited. I mean, it's all becoming aware of a huge widening abyss in the middle. Liz, I mean, am I right? Has he got our attention now in a new way to fundamental reality?
Yes, and I think Siva has done a wonderful job of explaining the consequences of these actions by state legislators that have really occurred over the last 20 years, and I don't think that most people are aware that those have happened. But one of the points that I'm worried about, and Siva seems a little less worried about, is that I think behind all these decisions to defund the public university systems is a philosophical shift among people that higher education is a private good. It is not a public good that taxpayers will support. I just think that's a really important shift, and I don't know how we correct that.
Who do we pin it on? I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, the Higher Ed Show, on the dangers, the distress in the prize U.S. industry. Thomas Frank gave us his take this week. He's the trend spotter and Omnicritic who wrote What's the Matter with Kansas 10 years ago about the conservative turn against public spending. In the Baffler magazine last week, Thomas Frank wrote a landmark piece, I think, about the frenzy in education to monetize and marketize the lifelong project of learning. He called it academic capitalism. Toward the end of a long podcast conversation that you can hear on our website, I asked Tom Frank for his cure.
The first thing is for some state to start funding their university properly, make tuition free or close to free, and make it excellent. It's not a pipe dream. It's not something crazy. It's something that existed up until fairly recently. Once you do that, once you apply competition, let's say NYU is charging students $60,000 a year, it's going to look pretty funny when they're trying to get you to pay that when it's free to go to, I don't know, the University of Wisconsin or something like that, which gives you a better education, you know.
Again, thank you, Noam Chomsky, but he reminds us that Mexico, a poor country, has free higher education. Finland has free higher education. Germany has free higher education.
Argentina has it. Israel has it.
You also speak in the Baffler, Tom, about eliminating the money drains. Meaning?
Fire the presidents. You know, these people drawing down $1 million a year, get rid of the football teams. I went to the University of Chicago for graduate school. They got rid of the football team back in the 1930s. You know, it was too much of a distraction. Today, it's too much of a money drain. A president making $1 million a year, there's absolutely no need for that. At a charitable institution, the idea is ludicrous. Just thin out the administration. Have the accreditation agencies come down like a ton of bricks on any university that uses more than 20% of their teaching with adjuncts. It's an outrage.
Tom, that's your wish list about how to get out of it. Where are we going? Where is this juggernaut going?
The direction that we're headed as a nation is toward setting up more private for-profit universities, constantly trying to solve the problem by using market forces to do it. And it won't work, but that's the only way we understand how to do things, it seems, anymore. Things are only going to get worse. I don't see any force that can change the status of adjuncts, for example. I don't see anybody that's rising up to challenge university administrations. And state governments, if anything, are becoming ever more desperate to cut taxes even more and cut funding to universities even more.
I hesitate to mention it, but when you get to my age, even halfway to your age, you realize, of course, that the value of the education is cumulative, it's lifelong, it's abstract, it's literary, it's imaginative. How would we redefine the route to grown-up happiness as something other than this marketized gateway? I mean, challenge the fundamental premise that this is the only way to happiness, to the full life.
That was a very moving description of what classical liberal arts education used to offer people. When President Obama, Tom Friedman, and so on talk about education, that's not what they're talking about. They're talking about essentially vocational training. They want you to major in engineering or math. To get what you just described, you don't even need to go to college. You just need to go on a course of reading. What college does is it enhances the experience by making it a collective generational thing. And also you have the instructors who are, you know, as you and I know, we both had wonderful college educations, and the instruction is such an enormous part of it. But maybe, you know, a handful of liberal arts professors can get together and offer this on a small scale on their own without an administration, without a football team. You know, there's all sorts of ways that we can still achieve that. Think about the other question of the credential. We didn't always look to universities for that. People rose up through work. They got a job and they rose up through the ranks at the company that they worked for, or they joined a union. These were all different ways of joining the middle class. There wasn't just this one way. But those other things seem to just be off the table now.
Yeah.
It just seems absurd to pay 60 grand a year so that you can read Rousseau. I mean, I can read Rousseau here. Hell, I can hire somebody to read it to me, teach me French, and then read it to me in French for that kind of money. It's nuts.
That was Thomas Frank from the Baffler magazine. We're talking about higher education with Liz McMillan, who's the editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education, with Siva Vaidyanathan, who teaches media and everything else at the University of Virginia, and with Joe Moore, who's the president of Lesley College in Cambridge. Is it nuts? Joe, speak directly to this administrative bloat question.
Well, let me first add that I'm always continuously fascinated by people with college degrees who are the ones questioning the value of college. The first-generation students at Lesley, Bunker Hill, whose families are working hard and they're working hard, they don't have this conversation. So I find that a curious thing.
They have it about the price, Joe.
The price, we've talked about it. It's a challenge. It's a problem. I acknowledge that. That's why our board has done something about it to the best of our ability. But we also need to think about what's going to happen new. We had the Morrill Act. We had the GI Act. We had the growth of community colleges. What's the next idea that people are working on that this country can actually do? And let me just suggest that somewhere in that mix is the community colleges as the great intake in this country.
Speak about it. You're advertising creativity all over the subway lines in Boston. Give us a creative breakthrough.
We need to be able to bring four-year institutions onto community college campuses so that those students can see a place where they can actually continue on. If they want to transfer to a campus, fine. But we also have to be careful that our conversation here doesn't equate the word students with the word kids. The majority of students in this country are adults. They are place-bound, they are working, they are raising families. We need to leverage technology, and we have community colleges that are within a half-hour drive of the vast majority of this country. We need to rethink our role. Lesley can't just be in Cambridge. And we need to think about how we can work with community college as along with other institutions to deal with large numbers. If we want to get an educated country, we have to have a vision, and that's where the federal government has played a huge role in our history and some very progressive state governments. And we need to really challenge the monetization of higher education and think about creative ways.
We're going to get creative right now, but you haven't mentioned the word bloat yet. I mean, where do the deans come from? Why had they become the permanent fixtures and the faculty temps?
I think that is an overstatement, and I invite you to talk specifically about which sector you're talking about. I think people would be find it ironic to think about bloat at our community colleges, which is where most people go. At the
I would agree with that, and I also think it's important to remember that when we're talking about that bloat, the bloat comes under this big file folder called administrators. Administrators
yes.
are everything from tutors right up through the president of the university. They're people who do a tremendous amount of the work to keep a university running.
Right.
Administrators are the ones who handle all the insurance claims at the hospital. Administrators are the ones who make sure that federal regulations are being followed in labs and in hospitals and in areas of universities where top security clearance is necessary. Administrators are the ones who are making sure that students get proper mental health care. Administrators are the ones who make sure that the dorms run right.
But they've,
expansions of the university's footprint, and many of them are mandated, actually, by increased federal oversight and state bureaucratic demands. So the increases in administration, that means a whole lot of different things. It doesn't just mean a bunch of extra deans.
Liz, have they not, all those administrative personnel, eclipsed the notion, as Helen Bender said to me years ago, and she was talking, dare I say, about Boston University, eclipsed the idea of the university as a community of scholars, first and last. Not a football team, not the buildings and grounds, not a high executive president, but scholars.
Well, I think there is probably some truth to that. And in some of the universities we've been talking about, some of those administrative duties were once handled by faculty. Certainly not in the last few years, as the regulatory burden of complying with so many different mandates, as Siva was mentioning, not necessarily that, but some core activities of building the curriculum and advising and really interacting with students. A lot of those responsibilities, as I understand it, have now moved on to deans and assistant deans.
Siva and Liz, let's get creative here. How would you shoot your way out of this crisis, if it is a crisis? Mm. Siva?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would actually take great stock of the amazing successes that we have had over 150 years. I think we should build on what we've done well. I think we should pay particular attention to the fact that this country got where it is because we were willing to admit that we're wealthy, and we're willing to spend money on things that don't necessarily have an immediate return, like, for instance, genetic research, which is something that never had an immediate return until very recently. You know, for 50 years, we poured money into genetic research before we figured out how to manipulate the genetic material of a tomato. You know, the fact that we seem unwilling to put money into intellectual speculation is going to drive us into a special form of poverty, a poverty driven by cynicism and a poverty driven by a lack of imagination. And that's when we lose. That's when we become the shallowest possible version of ourselves. So that's really what we have to take stock of. We have to recognize that we are a very, very wealthy nation. We've just chosen tax breaks for the rich and yachts for the rich over classrooms and books for the middle class. That's a bad decision, but we've also chosen that over basic science research, basic medical research, and the ability to think big thoughts about our status here on Earth.
Can you sell it? Can you practice it
scientifically?
Can you practice it, Siva, at Thomas Jefferson's own university? The same university, incidentally, where Thomas Frank went to school.
Yeah, no, right. Tom Frank is one of our great alums, and he actually was here a few months ago, and I spent a day with him, and he spoke to my students, and we had a bit of a back and forth about higher ed, and we agree in many cases. We both see, for instance, New York University as being the antithesis of all that is great about American higher education. It tends to suck money out of students and deliver very little, and treats its faculty and its graduate students like crap along the way. So we see that. We agree on that.
But, it's a perfect world.
Of course, I'm much more bullish on the work that is done at a place like UVA, because UVA is one of those places that certainly does not have administrative bloat. Its tuition is about $13,000 a year in-state right now, which is not crippling. That's, of course, the sticker price, not the price that most students actually pay. I think that's fairly reasonable. I would love it if it were below 10, and I'm sure everyone in the administration would also love it if it were below 10, and if we had more state support. If we had anywhere near the state support that the University of Maryland or the University of North Carolina has per student, and we get about a quarter of the state support per student compared to those other rivals, and you know, then we would be able to either lower tuition or hire a lot more faculty and do a lot more interesting work.
So hold it there. I want to ask.
We're not around to.
I want to ask Liz McMillan to join the vision sweepstakes.
Okay. One of the things that I have seen come up in the last few years is a real instrumentalist notion of what higher education is supposed to be about, that it has to produce something practical or even monetary. So to me, that would be a notion that would really need to be questioned and challenged. And at the same time that that's happened, the term liberal arts has become a dirty word, basically. It's liberal and it's arts, and it's feeding off the same kind of impulse that this, what I was just describing about instrumentalism. So I think the whole notion of the liberal arts could stand to be rehabilitated in the eyes of the public. I don't think people understand it, and I think they're suspicious of it because it's not going to lead to anything meaningful.
I'm happy to hear you say it. I wonder who is looking out for the intangibles in higher education, for the immeasurables, for the deep value. It was a very touching piece by Charles Blow in the New York Times website today about a teacher at Grambling in Louisiana not so long ago, but who turned his life around by coaching, by encouragement, by praise, among other things. But who's thinking of those immeasurables? Siva?
Well, I think that all three of us are, those of us who are on this program with you, you know, we all see it happen every day. We see the transformation in students who didn't know that they had a shot or didn't think that they had a chance. I mean, I see every day the, I guess you could call it a light bulb, go off, you know, above a student's head when she makes a connection that surprises me or surprises any other person who's read way too many books. And you know, when that happens, and that happens in a collective environment, and that enthusiasm spreads, that is about guiding a person, maybe a young person, maybe an older person, through a mode of thought, through a process of discovery, and engaging with that person in the exploration of knowledge. And that's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing that can yield actual, tangible, measurable results in the world down the line, perhaps years later, but it's really hard to draw that cause and effect. And that's one of the reasons that the instrumentalism that Liz is talking about is so nasty, is so pernicious to higher education, because the value that comes out of that conversation that might happen in May of 2014 won't necessarily make a measurable difference in the world for 20 or 30 years, but at some point, that habit of thought, that exposure, that light bulb going off is going to be part of a process that yields something else beautiful in the world.
I want to hear.
It might be a company, or it might just be a nice poem, and the world is better because of all of those things.
I want to hear Joe Moore's version of the light bulb. You're a strategist. What about the content, Joe?
The content is there, and it's been forced out of the public discourse, and it's going on every day at a place like Lesley, at the community colleges, at a lot of the public universities, at many universities. We are changing people's lives. The students are working hard. They're not as cynical as they're portrayed in the media. They have ambitions that are humanistic, that are very, very social, beyond political correctness. They want to do well and do good in this world. Mm-hmm. I see it every day in our faculty, and I could give story after story of it. It is not gone. It's been forced out because the policy is now all about how much you're going to make, what are the costs, what's the administrative bloat, what's the NCAA up to. My day is surrounded by some terrific students of all ages, faculty who are committed to their teaching and their applied scholarship. And that message we need to get out more, because I think that's the only way we change the policy discussion.
Stick with it. We're going to stay on this subject. We'll be back on the matter of higher education. It is, after all, our giant lifeline in the core of New England. Thank you, Liz McMillan. Thank you, Joseph Moore. Thank you, Siva Vaidyanathan. You can hear a longer excerpt of our terrific conversation with Thomas Frank on our website, radioopensource.org, where there's a lively discussion underway about what college is for and knockout infographics about the spiraling costs, if you can stand it. Please join us and share your own insights and experiences on the page, radioopensource.org. You can also find there the latest in our podcast series, Reading Chekhov. We're reading the story called About Love. Thanks also to Marion Wong at ProPublica, Howard Gardner at the Ed School at Harvard for help with this show. Our producers are Kunal Jasti, Max Larkin, and the engineer George Hicks, college men all. Mary McGrath is our dean for administration. I'm Christopher Lydon, ever the Yale history major. Join us next time on Open Source. Those were the best days of my life. I found myself.